marriage is the centerpiece of like a rich, rewarding life. It's this keystone. It's worth putting that kind of effort into, but most of us kid ourselves about whether we're investing enough to get out of it what we want to get.
Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa. Now that I'm a woman of a certain age, it seems like I'm dealing with a lot of slumps lately. You know, there's the general midlife slump, the 40-plus energy slump, the midwinter mood slump, the post-holiday financial slump, the I'm going to be an empty nester soon, and what does that even mean for me? Slump. And don't even get me started on the collagen slump that faces me in the mirror every day. Listen, slumps are everywhere, and that includes marriages. Even the best marriages are going to face dips in satisfaction. It's a well-documented fact. That's why I brought my new friend, Scott Braithwaite, onto the show. Scott's a doctor of clinical psychology, and when he isn't counseling couples, he's also researching what makes a healthy marriage. Scott will explain more about marriage slumps, some of their causes, and what to do about them, and how to make the most of our relationships with 6 slump-beating strategies. Here is Dr. Scott Braithwaite.
My name is Scott Braithwaite. I'm a professor here at BYU. I'm in the clinical psychology program. I chose clinical psychology because it lets me do a lot of things. And so I like to do all the things that I can do. I teach, I do research, I have a practice, and I also kind of work with other groups and organizations. And then the main thing that I study with my research is essentially how to create as much relationship health as we can. I focus mostly on married couples, but systems in general are kind of my thing, whether it's families, whether it's bigger things like teams. To me, that's really what I just find exciting.
I love that, relationship health. And that's what I would love to talk about today. I think you get into these habits, the busyness of life. Are there things that you wish you could tell people who'd been married for a long time to just do a well check, for lack of a better term, on their relationship?
Yeah. The science here is like unimpeachable. We know for sure that this is true, but it's not common knowledge, and I think it's worth saying out loud. So if we think about the typical trajectory of marriage satisfaction, when it starts, hopefully it's high. It usually starts high, and then here's what happens. It kind of slides down like this,
okay.
But you get a little bump at the end,
okay.
And then you die.
Yes.
Okay. So the thing that starts that slide down is the birth of the first child. The thing that starts to give you the bump is when the last child leaves the house.
Now,
people don't think this because they think my children are what give meaning to my life, and they do, for sure. But what happens during those middle years is you get really busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't actually prioritize your relationship. So that bump at the end comes from that couple kind of looking at each other and going, oh, yeah, I forgot about you. Like, we should hang out. And they do.
You're cool.
And it starts to, like, get a little bit better.
Remember those yahoos that just left our house?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Marriage satisfaction doesn't have a straight trajectory. Even the best marriages won't have high satisfaction all the time. That's science. Also, it's kids. Bless their hearts. But that satisfaction slump Dr. Braithwaite was talking about doesn't have to be a drastic or devastating dip that ends in misery or divorce. I think all marriages would love a good happiness bump, regardless of where they are on the timeline. One of the first ways to increase the health and satisfaction in our partnerships is to eliminate what he calls the simple stories we create in our marriages.
The opening scenes of couple therapy, they're pretty predictable. People come in and everyone has, the term that I use is they have a simple story. And both of those words matter. It's simple in that there's good guys and bad guys. And usually they're the good guy. And their spouse is the bad guy. Not like in the worst kind of way, but just sort of like, our marriage could be so easy if you would just fix these one or two things that drive me crazy. And so when they meet with me, because I always meet with them individually before I meet with them as a couple, they're kind of saying, you and I are going to gang up and we're going to fix this other person. We're going to get them to be better. And then my marriage is going to be great. And I believe that they think that. I just think that the story is too simple. And so a lot of times what you're trying to do is to complicate the stories with a little bit more reality, because usually there's a lot of different kind of steps to the dance that they're doing. Mm. And everybody is complicit in that dance in ways that work and in ways that don't work. And trying to get to the root of that is way more important than trying to say, oh, you win, you're the right one, and the other person is the wrong one.
Slump strategy number one, ditch the simple story and realize that marriage slumps aren't usually about good spouses versus bad spouses. Partner dynamics are complicated, and both partners play a role in them, whether they realize it or not. Talking with a good therapist who has a fresh set of eyes and an objective view is one way to change out simple narratives for more accurate and healthy stories. Another idea Dr. Braithwaite shared is to look for the four big danger patterns in marriage. And I'll give you a hint. Arguing is not one of them.
Sometimes people will brag that they've never had an argument. I don't believe them.
Yeah.
But they'll kind of say, oh, we've never had an argument. I think it means that they're both really pretty passive. And hopefully both of them are. Because if not, then one of them is kind of eating the other's lunch, right?
Right.
But that's kind of the idea, is that you can make that work. Other times, couples are really volatile. They'll mix it up quite a bit. That seems on its face like it should be bad, but in and of itself, it's not. Like, in fact, if you're going to just pick how volatile the communication is, it's the low volatility that has the best prediction of poor outcomes, because usually it means that one person isn't saying what
they want to say.
They're making that marriage work by keeping their mouth shut. But if they're both talking, then my guess is that they're going to work through a lot of these things. So it's not conflict per se, but there are certain patterns of conflict that are really problematic that we're going to watch out for, and that we're going to try to coach them away from and make sure that they have tools to deal with those. If I worked with a younger couple and they come and kind of sheepishly admit that they just had their first big fight, I'm more apt to be like, oh, good. Like, I'm really glad. Like, what was it about? Let's talk about it. But I think in their minds, they had maybe a perfectionistic idea of, we're just never going to get mad at each other. We're never going to have a disagreement, raise our voices. And I'm like, oh, but you will. Okay. So I think that sometimes we just think that having disagreements, having differences, or just that kind of conflict is bad in of itself. There's ways of fighting that are mean and nasty that we want to watch out for. But for the most part, like, I see it as like a healthy, constructive part of building a life together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then conversely, are there things that people think, oh, that's not a big deal, but actually is a very big deal?
Yes. A key one is invalidation. Invalidation is when we sort of act as if the other person's perspective is stupid, is dumb, is not worthy of being listened to. What you're really watching for with invalidation is less what they say and more how they say it. It's a body language type thing.
Okay.
So when people are rolling their eyes or kind of just like huffing and those kinds of things, what it subtly communicates is what you're saying is so stupid and so wrong that I can hardly let you finish that sentence because it's just so bad. That's invalidation. And so we want to watch out for that, but mostly because invalidation sets the stage for the next one, which is escalation. So when someone feels like you're not listening, you don't actually hear what I'm saying, they'll up the ante by getting louder, meaner, just more intense in some way. They're doubling down to just say, oh, you think that's stupid? What about? And they'll just kind of go at them a little bit harder. That tends to then start this pattern where they negatively escalate, and a conversation that starts about where we leave our socks. Now we've introduced the idea of whether we should have even married each other in the first place. That's escalation.
Wow, that's a lot of escalation.
Yeah, but it's not uncommon. Like I'll say, it's a pretty common thing. So we're looking for invalidation. We're looking for escalation. This one, I think among religious people, actually shows up the most. We call it the demand withdraw pattern, where you have a demander and a withdrawer. Both of them are actually doing things that they think are good for the relationship. Mm-hmm. The demander is kind of saying, to have a good relationship, we've got to make some changes. We have to do some things differently. We have to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And so they're actively pursuing trying to get that to happen because they really do feel like it's how they're going to make the marriage better. The withdrawer also has a theory about how to make marriage good, and it is, let's just never fight. The best thing we can do is just never fight. So sometimes they'll withdraw when the demanding happens by being like, okay, they'll just get up and go. But more common, especially among couples who can be a little perfectionistic and want to do this just right, what they'll do is they won't meaningfully engage in the conversation.
Hmm.
And they can do that a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's by saying nothing. Sometimes it's by being hyper agreeable and just going, yeah, okay, all right. And they think they're being the best communicator ever, but that's not meaningful engagement in the conversation, so it gets coded as a withdrawal.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and here's why the demand withdraw pattern is so sneaky. Like, it seems good, and in the short run it is, because you typically do avoid a fight in the short run. But over time—
Or escalating.
Right, yeah. Over time, though, you erode intimacy. I mean, like a feeling of being close and connected and like we know how to turn toward each other. Yeah. And so over time, you develop this pattern of just saying we deal with problems by not talking about them, by not bringing up this issue. And often that lands more on one partner than the other, where they're kind of saying the best way to make this marriage work is just to not need things and to not ask for things that I need. And I'll just kind of carry a little bit more load here. And that works in the short term, but I see those couples 20 years later. And that person who's carrying that load is just like, yeah, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. Because that strategy doesn't work long term. Mm. So I try to root that out pretty quickly. The last one, if we're going to complete the four, we call it negative interpretations, is this idea that I tend to read into what you're saying in a way that assumes darker motives, or that assumes that you're saying something that sounds good, but I know what you really mean. And it's not right. So it's mind reading in a negative way. It's kind of saying, I think I know what you really mean, and I think it's not as noble as you're kind of
projecting. Assuming the best for your partner is the goal.
Here's the thing that's funny for me about that is sometimes people think that psychology is about the power of positive thinking, assuming the best. I'm a big fan of like truth. What I mean by that is I don't want you to assume anything. I want you to get at what's really going
on. To get clarification. Is that what you mean?
I want reality. So I want you to not assume. I want you to ask. I want you to be curious. I want you to communicate until it's like, I really feel like we understand each other. So I want to take the assuming down. It's true that like I would rather people assume the best than the worst for sure. But in the end, I'm kind of like, that still feels like a short-term strategy. I want you to get real with each other.
Yeah.
I want you to find the real connection between the two of you. Even if there's a difference, we don't need to be scared of that. We don't need to like shy away from that.
We can be different about how we feel about things.
But,
okay.
But let's be curious about each other so that we can figure out where we really are. Because once we have that truth, we're so much wiser.
Slump strategy number two, do an inventory for the big four red flags in marriage: invalidation, escalation, demand withdraw patterns, and negative interpretations. Each of these patterns are concerning, but they are also patterns that can be fixed. A third strategy Dr. Braithwaite suggests to improve our marriage health is to consider what we can accept in our spouse.
If we start to get a clear picture of what's going on, I'm sorting in my head, what here should we focus on changing? And what here should we focus on accepting? And acceptance in this case doesn't mean you can't change that, so sorry, just nothing we can do. But it's a whole different set of strategies that essentially starts from the premise of saying, given that this is true, and it's unlikely to change or impossible to change, how can we make sure that this doesn't chew us up and eat us alive as a couple? And that sometimes takes a little bit of convincing, because everybody wants to change things. They usually want to change the other person, though. And sometimes acceptance is this paradoxical thing where if I just get real about the fact that I can't control everything, and instead of trying to control that thing in a way that makes my marriage worse, I say, I'm going to let go of that. And I'm going to start to kind of say, I think that I can be more patient, more loving, more kind, and just have a little more grace for this thing that doesn't work for me. Ironically, then often that thing starts to change because we're in a system. And systems aren't just this direct kind of, you pull this lever, that change happens. There's lots of feedback loops. There's delayed responses. And a lot of times it's our rigidity around an issue that makes it stay stuck. And so when we start to get flexible and things start to just flow, we get more of what we want. But it's an act of faith, because most people don't believe that will happen. They have a theory of change in their head that is too simple, and that I can just, to be blunt, I can just criticize someone into being wonderful. And it has
never worked
in the history of mankind. Do you know what I mean? So, but it's like such an instinctive gut level strategy that we go to it again and again.
slump strategy number 3, skip the criticism and figure out what you can accept. And we're not talking about accepting serious things here, like disrespect and neglect and abuse. We're talking about accepting the way our spouse chews, their tendency to be late, how they leave their clothes on the floor. You know, you get the idea. Instead of trying to fix our spouse, Scott suggests we try to figure out how to accept our spouse. And in doing so, offering that kind of grace may just provide an unexpected and even miraculous bump in marriage satisfaction that we were looking for all along. A 4th thing we can do is to get better at knowing when to engage and when to give ourselves a timeout.
You can actually tell when you do those couple interaction videos. You can tell how it's going to go from like the first, I would say 30 seconds. You probably don't need 30 seconds because you can see if they're coming in hot or if they're actually trying really hard to just say, I want to show you respect and patience, but there's a problem and I want to address it. Mm-hmm. And if people start softer, even if they're not great communicators, it just tends to go really well because these two people are together because they love each other.
Right.
And as long as we stay tuned into that, the fact that we love each other and we don't get defensive and we don't start activating these other things that are going to get in the way of that, mm-hmm. if we just really connect on the fact that we love each other, and loving means that we start with that kind of softer, more patient way of doing things, that's probably a key thing. So I will say that if I'm worked up and I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
For me, one of the things that I'll do is I'll say, I probably don't want to be worked up when I talk about it. That's not always possible. But the rule of thumb for me is I'll ask myself, can I articulate like a really good version of my wife's perspective here? Mm-hmm. And if I can't, I probably shouldn't talk to her.
Okay. If I can articulate a good version of my partner's perspective,
in my own
then
head.
I think I'm ready.
Right. If in my own head, I'm kind of like, I can see how from her perspective, this made a lot of sense and she was acting in good faith and it just didn't work out the way she thought it would. You know, if I can really see that, then I can do a really good job probably of communicating. If I'm just like, wow, what a selfish jerk. I'm probably not going to communicate very well. I need to do more work to make sure that I'm ready to go in with the goal of communicating well. And to try to treat her with love and respect.
And that's not necessarily just time waiting. Mm-hmm. It's intention.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Anytime that we get into that simple story, we're going to have a hard time really doing a good job of treating the other person as if they have a good point of view. So sometimes it's just saying, oh, I think I'm being too simplistic in my own head. I need to take a second to try to see this from another perspective.
Are you a fan of asking, hey, is this a good time to have this conversation now? Or just identifying those sort of opportunities?
So the thing that I'll teach couples, if we're talking about like a tool, mm-hmm. is I'll ask them to use what's called a timeout. Timeout isn't like calling a timeout on your kid, right? Like it's not like you're going to send them to their room or something. It's more so just saying that like we see enough danger signs here that we're not going to do a good job. And most people who love each other, if you get them calmed down, they're going to do just fine. Like, you won't need more technique than this. And so, to me, the timeout...
That's very encouraging.
Yeah, yeah. I'm very much like a minimum effective dose person.
Oh, yeah.
I think being authentic and connecting really matters, but sometimes emotion will get in the way. So we'll just say, go and, like, see if you can turn down that emotion. Because when that's happening, you're just running on instinct. You're not really going to do a very good job. So if we can just take a minute to soothe ourselves and talk, that's great. If either person doesn't feel like it's a good time to talk, I say that you respect it. You just kind of say, either one of us, it doesn't have to be both of us. They can just say, I just am a little too in my head. Let's talk about this later. I think you have to respect that.
Yeah.
But whoever says it's not a good time to talk needs to be the one who brings it back up. And they need to do it within 24 hours is my rule of thumb. Because otherwise, we're just going to get into a fancy avoidance and withdrawal pattern. So if someone says, I need some space to collect my thoughts, totally fair game. But then the burden is now on them to say, I'm going to bring it back up.
Yeah.
So that it doesn't feel like I'm just leaving
you within a short amount of time. So it's just not brewing.
That's right. I just think in a way that's likely to get what you want. Most of us want to be heard.
Yeah.
And we want to build more connection.
Yes.
Like usually when we're mad, it's not because we're trying to get something. It's that we're like, I feel really hurt and wounded by you. And I want to repair that. I want to be closer together. And so just dealing with emotion is critical.
What kind of emotions are we talking about, or what could we look for?
What I would say is in the short term, what we need to do is we need to re-engage the prefrontal cortex part of your brain. Because when we are really amped up emotionally, our sympathetic nervous system gets activated, our flight or flight kind of system. And in that situation, it's going to perceive the other person as an enemy to be conquered. It's not even a choice that you're making. It's just something that is happening because cortisol is just flooding through your system and your body is just like in this mode where it's like, I just have to protect myself.
Yes.
None of us do well in that situation. In some of these studies, what we found is that people are sitting in a chair just like us. And if either of them has a heart rate that's over 100 beats per minute, there is a 0% chance that they will have good communication.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not to say that sometimes it goes well. It never goes well. So in the short term, we have to turn down that intense emotion and re-engage the part of us that can think, that can be rational, that can connect with our values. And for me, the cue that that is going to happen is what I said earlier. It's this idea that can I articulate a really good version of the other person's perspective? And if I can't, I'm probably not going to do a very good job. If I can, things are probably pretty good.
Slump strategy number 4, work on our timing. You know, they say timing is everything, but it really is a lot, not just in acting and parenting, but in how we deal and when we deal with our partner. If we can't genuinely and fairly articulate our partner's viewpoint without negative emotion creeping in, we should consider giving ourselves a little time so our prefrontal cortex can catch up to the conversation. Timeouts aren't just for toddlers. They're for healthy marriages too. Dr. Braithwaite says a fifth thing we can do to improve our marriage, and I love this one, is focus on the importance of body language. Any Little Mermaid fans out there? No? Okay, cool. Here's why he says it's so important.
There was a study we did a long time ago where the researchers were saying what matters most, what you say, how you say it, or your body language.
Oh.
Their prediction was, of course, what you say matters the most. Tone is probably second, body language is probably third.
Okay.
The results were completely flipped. Just
completely flipped.
Completely flipped. Our body language, the way that we relate to each other, that is a clear number one. The second is tone.
Wow.
But tone is like, it's like a distant second. It's not like neck and neck. It's pretty far behind.
Oh, yeah. That surprises me.
And then the actual content is by far the least important thing.
Wow.
So when couples come in, a lot of times they're like, I need to catch you up on what happened in the last week. And I'm like, I don't think you do. Like, just jump right in. And I have a feeling like I'll be able to follow along enough because I'm so much more focusing on the process of them communicating than I am the actual words that they're saying. People way overvalue the importance of words. They undervalue the pattern, the body language, the tone. And the words matter, but in the end, like, you can probably get away with some of the wrong words if you got the other two figured out.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to be thinking about that for a long time. So you talk about that positive body language is the most important thing in setting up a good conversation. What does that look like? I mean, I think I know.
Yeah, I suspect that you do know. I would say, in general, you just want to have an open stance. Anything that kind of calms and makes you look like you are relaxed and like you're curious and interested. Mm-hmm. That's the body language that we're looking for. It's just, I'm open, I'm interested, I'm oriented towards you.
Engaged.
When you talk, I'm taking it in. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing things like rolling my eyes, scoffing, you know, just things like that. So for the most part, it's cutting out things that we probably know we should cut out.
Speaking of body language, we all knew this was coming, but looking at phones instead of our partners speaks volumes to our spouse.
There's this thing called fubbing, P-H-U-B-B-I-N-G, and it's snubbing the other person with your phone, which just means that someone is talking to you. I don't even have my phone because I'm so good at this.
Because you're so engaged.
Yeah, I'm so good at this.
I know.
Most people actually don't know that they're doing it. Like, our relationships with our phones have become so automatic that it's almost an unconscious thing. And we always feel as if when we do it, we're justified. We're like, well, obviously, I'm just coordinating with the
babysitter. I'm just checking work. Yeah, it was my kid.
Yeah, or something like that. But it doesn't ever feel that way to the other person. Yeah. So certainly maybe having some firm rules about there are places in our life that our phone doesn't belong. I could say some that I think are good. The dinner table seems like a great place, that maybe we just don't need phones. And even if there's research that shows that if your phone is there, it still kind of degrades the quality of your attention. If you want to be extreme, when you get home, you have a place where you put your phone. almost like it's a home phone, right?
Yeah.
And that allows us to spend more time connecting because most of us don't realize how much we pick up our phone and how much time we spend on our phone.
Yeah.
So I would say just...
And talk about body language.
Yeah, yeah. And it really communicates, I'm so uninterested in what you're saying.
Yeah.
So it's a mix of
my
withdrawal.
My focus is somewhere else.
And kind of that invalidation of just like, you're not worth listening to because I'm going to do this.
So even though it's kind of an automatic thing, it actually is a really big deal.
So we just want to be really intentional with it.
Slump strategy number 5, work on your body language, and that includes your cell phone use. I love that body language can compensate for not saying the right thing, but that's why it's so important to get the body language right, because it speaks louder than the words themselves. The final and most important thing that Dr. Braithwaite says is the foundation of a healthy marriage is not romance, it's friendship.
If I were to try to put one thing as just the foundation, I would call it friendship. I would say that like is a very sturdy emotion. And I've seen lots of couples who I think they would say that they're still in love with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they like each other very much. They've been together for a long time and they're kind of like, I'd take a bullet for that person, but don't make me spend the afternoon with them, right? Like, I just don't like to be around them.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I think that making sure that like is a foundation that you cultivate and that you try to build and that you really work on is more important than keeping romance and all those other things alive. I think they're all important, but I think that that one is the bulk of the foundation.
Do you feel like that there are certain habits that help a couple's health or well-being?
Yeah, here's the one I'll share. If a couple comes in, again, for couple therapy, one of the first things that I'll ask them to do is I'll say, how about this? I would love for the two of you to stop working on your marriage. We're going to do all that hard stuff in here because they think that working on your marriage is talking about the hard stuff. And it is.
Oh.
It is. But I say, let's do that together. And here's what I want you to do in between sessions. I want you to have fun and be friends. And I want you to remember what that looks like because usually when people are dating, they're pretty good at having fun and being friends. They're not so invested in trying to change the other person. They're just like trying to learn about the other person and trying to like get more information about them, spend more time with them, do more fun things together. Most couples don't realize it, but they have completely stopped doing that.
Oh, they don't realize it.
They don't realize it because they got busy. They got busy doing other things because there's so many other things they need to do. And they thought their marriage was just going to take care of itself. But what I'm really saying is start working on your marriage by working on friendship, having fun, feeling connected, doing the positive things that are the reasons you got together in the first place.
Which could be a bunch of habits.
And we'll do the taking out the garbage stuff in here because you have to take out the garbage.
Yeah.
But if your whole life is about taking out the garbage, it's no fun.
Yeah.
And so take out the garbage once a week. And then the rest of the time, live your life. Have fun. Be friends. We say this is the most important relationship in our life. And I believe that's true, but you got to act like it. And that means that you have to take time. And it's great to go on dates. This is usually what couples say is we have a date night.
Yeah.
But then when I ask about date night, I'm like, what'd you do?
Yeah.
They're like, well, we grabbed some food and then we dropped by Walmart. And I'm just like, anything that involves Walmart is, it's off limits. You don't get to do that.
Romantic.
Sorry if Walmart is a sponsor of this show,
but
you cannot count that as a date. That is not a thing that actually is building connection.
Yeah.
So I need to find ways to kind of like act like this is our most important relationship. And most people don't do that because they're awful people. They do it because they're busy. They do it just because they get busy doing other really important things. This is the most important thing, though. We have to act like it. I think most of us give ourselves a little too much credit for how hard we try. Marriage is the centerpiece of like a rich, rewarding life. It makes you a better parent. I think it makes you better at all these other parts of your life. It's this keystone. It's worth putting that kind of effort into, but most of us kid ourselves about whether we're investing enough to get out of it what we want to get.
Well said. Dr. Braithwaite says that investing in our marriage might look like doing these things together.
We spend a lot of time dreaming about the future.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time saying, oh, it's going to be like this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to have this. And then when we get kind of, you know, 25 years in and we're these grizzled old people, we're just kind of like, did you get milk? You know, like, and we don't do as much dreaming.
Did you remember to take the trash out?
Yeah. So even just doing things like spending time dreaming about the future, go out to eat. But instead of just eating, like, spend some time, like, what do we want the next 5 or 10 years to look like? Like, what are we looking forward to? What are we excited about? How can we bring that vision into reality? We just stop having those conversations. So it's those kinds of things. It's just remembering that this is, like, a really, really important person, not to take them for granted, to be really curious, to ask a lot of questions, to be a good listener, and to invite them to talk about things that are important to them. And then it's also great to have fun, to do things that are kind of different. There's a lot of research that shows if you do novel things, they don't even have to be exciting, but they have to be different than what you normally do. That actually improves your relationship. So even if it's like nonsensical, like bungee jumping, anything that is novel, that's different, actually seems to create more of a memorable connection and invite some of this other stuff. So those would be some examples.
Slump strategy number 6, and this is the big one. Focus on your friendship. It's the foundation of every good marriage and the capstone to the other strategies Dr. Braithwaite shared today. So just to review, those strategies are: first, get rid of simple stories that paint our spouse as the bad guy. Second, do an inventory for invalidation, escalation, demand withdrawal patterns, and negative interpretations in your marriage. Third, find things you can accept about your spouse and accept them with grace. Fourth, don't engage in conversation when emotions are high and take advantage of timeouts. Fifth, focus on your body language because it matters more than what you say. Sixth, foster friendship in your marriage. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and add a seventh suggestion, which is have your spouse listen to this episode too, so you can both be on the same page as you work on these things together. It will give you a common language. You can both make fun of me at the same time together. It will give you inside jokes. You know, I'm here to help. No marriage is going to be perfect, and some marriages are going to end. But for those marriages that are still in the thick of things and are feeling the inevitable slump, don't buy into the old Dr. Seuss line that reads, "When you're in a slump, you're not in for much fun. Unslumping yourself is not easily done." While slumps may not be fun, there's actually a lot we can do to unslump our relationships. Perhaps we can start by putting our phones down, making eye contact with the person we married, and realizing that we aren't just looking at a romantic partner, but a friend.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Eric Price with help from Becca Hurley-Lung, Blake Morse, and Kenny Mears. Post-production by Gracie Davis. A special thanks to today's guest, Scott Braithwaite. Scott is a professor of psychology at Brigham Young University. Don't miss out on two other great podcasts from the Lisa Show family, The Council of Moms and Proofread, a new book review podcast to help you read more of what you love. You can find The Council of Moms and Proofread on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. As always, thanks for your messages. We read them all, and thanks for listening.
Do you find yourself avoiding the news because of how depressive and divisive it all seems, but you still want to stay informed on important issues? Then let me introduce you to Top of Mind, a BYU Radio original podcast just for you. Each episode, the Top of Mind team takes on one tough topic and dives deep, exploring both sides of the debate and finding common ground. Listening to Top of Mind will help you clarify your own views while challenging your way of thinking. In a polarizing world, Top of Mind is about developing empathy for others and their perspectives and staying informed about current topics in a positive, honest, and thought-provoking way. Top of Mind gives you tools to become an effective citizen and kind neighbor while also learning how to be an advocate for the things that matter most to you. Hosted by award-winning journalist Julie Rose, every episode will leave you feeling empowered and hopeful. Listen to Top of Mind on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.